When we began this seminar about 12 years ago, we were zeroing in on the area of the formerly married, that is, divorced and widowed persons. However, recently we've come to realize that the seminar relates to never marrieds as well as formerly marrieds. Some of the best results we've had recently have been from never marrieds who said to us, I now know why I'll get into a relationship, but the moment they began to talk about marriage or something like that, I run. We'll talk about that tomorrow morning when we talk about how to trust after being burned, because I believe that never marrieds have just as much problem with trust as formerly marrieds. We're going to be dealing with 10 different topics as we talk about picking up the pieces. The first one, as Mike has said, is making the most of a difficult situation. I want to begin by making this statement. Take hope. Life is not over. Anytime one begins to feel that the best days of their life are behind them, they are guilty of emotional suicide. Oftentimes I'll meet a lady who will express to me a statement like this. She says, my husband died, and now then I feel like the best days of my life are behind me, and I can hardly wait until I can die and be reunited with him in heaven. And I say, hey, do you realize what you're saying? You're no longer living. All you're doing is existing. Or a lady will say, I gave that sorry so-and-so the best 20 years of my life, and he walked out on me. And I look and say, listen, if you want, the best 20 years of your life are not behind you, but are in front of you, because if you will grow through what has happened to you, you will become a better person, and as you become a better person, you will have more to give someone else. And so I say, take hope. Life is not over, because God promises in every situation to work good. God is at work in your life, always attempting or desiring to work something good in your life and to make every moment work for good. In Romans 8:28, we read that God works in all things for good to them that love the Lord, who are called according to his purpose. This does not mean that God causes evil things to happen. What it simply means is that God works in every situation in a way to accomplish something good. And I can always say, take hope. God is working something good in your life. I was doing a study of the passage in Romans 8 and was directed back to the 50th chapter of the book of Genesis. After Joseph's father died, his brothers, somewhat fearful that Joseph would get even with them for selling him into slavery, came and said, now, Dad said to remind you that we're your brothers. And he said, hey, why do you fear, seeing that I sit in the place of God? You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good to save much people alive. Here in the 50th chapter of the book of Genesis is a statement that says that God actually took an evil deed and used it to accomplish something good in the lives of his people. Listen carefully. Some of you will have difficulty accepting this statement, but for some of you, one of the best things that's ever happened to you has been the ending of your marriage or a relationship that you've been involved in. As we go along, you'll begin to tie into that statement and understand why I can say something like that. But the Bible simply states that here was a situation where evil was intended, but God used it to accomplish something good in the lives of his people. I continued to reflect upon that over a period of several years and began to think about David. Here was a man who committed adultery, and in an attempt to cover the adulterous relationship with Bathsheba, committed murder. And yet the Bible states that because David grew through the experience, do you catch the key? Because he grew through the experience, the Bible can refer to David as a man after God's own heart. I was continuing to reflect about that, and one day I walked into a service. I confess that after the preacher read his text, I did not hear another word he said. He was going to be speaking on the Lordship of Christ that day, and so what he did was took an Old Testament passage that he was going to use as a basis, if you will, to show how that we were to allow Christ to be Lord of our lives. The passage was from the life of David, when just prior to David's death, there arose a controversy among his sons as to who would reign in David's stead. And finally someone said, let's ask David. And David said, Solomon shall reign in my stead. Do you recall who Solomon was? David's son by whom? Bathsheba. Though the child conceived in the adulterous relationship died, The second child born to that relationship was anointed by God as king over Israel, and there are no doubts about his being God's chosen king of Israel. God worked in that situation good, and my mind began to reflect upon that thought. Here is how God can work even in a bad situation to accomplish something good. So I say, take hope. Expect something good, because basically we get what we're looking for. When you awaken in the morning, do you expect something beautiful to happen, or, oh no, another bad day? What bad's going to happen to me today? I know it's got to be bad, because that's just the way I look at life. Or do you awaken with the expectation that God, who loves you, wants to do something good in spite of all the bad things that have already happened to you? And I always tell people, determine to make this the beginning of the best days of your life. This past week, I celebrated my 50th birthday. And everybody says, Clyde, it's over now. And I want you to know I'm expecting better in the days to come than I've ever had in the days past. I believe that this is the beginning of one of the most exciting times of my life. So I say to people, take hope. Then if you're going to make the most of your present situation, the difficulties in which you find yourself, you have got to accept responsibility. I believe the oldest game of mankind is the game of passing the buck. Have any of you ever heard Flip Wilson on TV say, "The devil made me do it"? Do any of you know where that originated? It was not with Flip. Does anyone know? The third chapter of Genesis. Please note, after Adam and Eve sinned, God, as was his custom, came to have fellowship with Adam and Eve. Please note that. It's not the reverse. God came to have fellowship. He did not reject them, turn his back on them. He came to have fellowship with Adam and Eve. And as he approached the garden, Adam and Eve heard him coming, and they ran and hid themselves. God got in the garden and says, "Okay, Adam, what happened?" Please note Adam's response. "The woman you gave me." Not only did he blame the woman, he also blamed God. Did you catch that? "The woman you gave me, she made me do it." And the woman said, "The serpent made me do it." And we've been blaming someone else ever since then. I wish I had a dollar for every time someone has said to me, "Some vicious woman broke up my happy marriage." Listen to me carefully. No third person ever broke up a healthy marriage. All the third person did was give the second person the impetus to do what they've been wanting to do for some time. It had to have some defects in it, or the third person would have never had an entree, never been able to even get inside. I'd be so glad when we move beyond the victim-villain concept of divorce. You know, that's the concept that says this vicious villain perpetrates this dastardly deed upon this innocent victim. The tragedy of it is everybody is victimized. The villain is victimized because he or she is ostracized from the one place they can get help: the church. The victim is further victimized because no one will tell he or she they need scope. That is, they're not perfect. And the children are victimized because they've got to decide who is the good guy and who's the bad guy, and you love the good guy and hate the bad guy. Some of you are beginning to tie in because you know exactly what's happened. You've seen it happen in your own situation. Hey, what I'm getting at is we've got to come to the place that we began to accept responsibility for ourselves and where we are and tie into that. We've got to come to the place that we realize we are influenced but not affected. There's a difference here. Influence says everything that happens in my world to me influences the way I perceive life, the way I see things. Affected says it determines my response. Do you catch the key? I cannot always determine what's going to happen around me. But I am responsible for how I respond to that given situation. Everything that my parents did, good and bad, has had an influence upon me. But when I stand before God, He's going to be concerned about what I did with my life rather than what they did at that moment. I'm influenced, but not affected. Also, I come to realize that I am responsible for my own happiness. So often I'll hear someone say, "Boy, if I could just get married, I'd be happy." And I say immediately, please don't get married, because if you do, there will then be two unhappy people you and the one you marry, because a happy marriage is two happy people sharing their joy one with another. No one is ready to get married until they're happy being single, until they're happy where they are. Are you happy tonight? If you're not, then that's the number one responsibility that you have, is to learn how to be content, happy, wherever you might be. We're responsible for our choices. Sometimes these choices might be somewhat limited, as if a person has a .357 Magnum 12 inches from your forehead. It may be life or death, but you still have a choice. It's how you respond to them. There are things that are happening to me all the days of my life. People drive crazily sometimes, and I cannot help that, but I'm charged with how I choose to respond to that person. And then I am responsible for my own identity. We have a book for couples that will be out shortly. And in the first chapters, I sought to understand what a good marriage is from the biblical perspective. Doing a study of the second chapter of Genesis, I came to realize that a good marriage is two people coming together to assist or help each other to become all that they were created by God to be. In other words, it's a mutual assistance relationship, building one another up. And any time a relationship destroys the identity of another person, that is not a good relationship. That is a destructive relationship. That is a form of murder. That's the reason for some of you, one of the best things that's happened to you has been the fact that you are now single. I'm thinking of a lady whose husband was principal of the local school. He retired at the end of the school year, and the following November was killed in a car wreck. At the time of his death, she had never written a check, did not know where their savings accounts were, and to this day, I'm not sure that she's ever gained everything that was rightfully hers. I'm thinking of another lady who had not even finished high school, married a guy who had a degree in engineering. He got a job with a space program. A number of years later, they went through a divorce. She had merely been an extension of her husband, did not even know who she was, any concept of her identity, did not think she could do anything for herself. She had to go back to school and learn how a trade so that she could become a person within her own right. All I'm saying is that sometimes we've got to realize that our responsibility under God is to be the person He created us to be, because that's ultimately what success is. And so I come to the place that I accept responsibility for myself and where I am. Then I've got to face reality. The reality, first of all, of the death of a marriage. Marriages can die, just like they're born. There's a death of a marriage when death comes about, because the Bible is very clear in teaching us that contrary to what many people may think, and contrary to the words of a song that are often sung at weddings, we will not walk hand in hand in heaven as husband and wife. On one occasion, a member of the Sadducees that did not believe in the resurrection approached Jesus and said, "Now, Master, you know our custom. A man died leaving no male heir. Therefore, our custom says that she is to marry the next of kin." So he marries the brother, who also dies. And the next brother marries her. On to seven brothers. Whose wife will she be in heaven? And Jesus simply said, "You do not even know how to ask the question, because in heaven there is no giving or receiving of marriage." I personally believe that in heaven we will all be brother and sister. That's the heavenly relationship. Now, let me hasten to say that if you've lost a mate by death, the brother-sister relationship of heaven will be more intimate, more complete, more loving than the best husband-wife relationship upon earth, because then we will know perfect love. But we've also got to face the death of a marriage in a divorce. You see, what a divorce is the funeral of a dead marriage. Most marriages die anywhere from 3 to 5 years before the funeral. No judge ever causes a divorce. All he does is the same thing a doctor does in a death. In a death, the doctor signs a piece of paper that says, I certify that this person is legally dead. In a divorce, what you find is he signs a piece of paper that says, I certify that this marriage is legally dead. But wait a minute, Clyde. Don't you know that divorce is contrary to God's ideal? So is death. When you read the Bible, you find that death was not a part of God's original plan. It is a reality in the world in which we live because of sin. And we've got to accept it as a reality. Therefore, I think it's high time we come to realize that we've got to accept the reality of the death of marriages in divorce. But I hear people say, but Clyde, you don't understand. There are so many things that can be done. Yes, I know there are things that can be done, but sometimes we've got to face the hard, cold reality that it is a reality of the world in which we live. For instance, suppose a woman came to you and said, listen, I've learned that my husband is putting arsenic in my coffee. Just a little bit, but it'll kill me in about 3 to 6 months. What would be your advice to her? Don't drink the coffee. Yeah, someone always said, don't drink the coffee. You heard about the man who had 3 wives that died? The first wife died from eating poisoned mushrooms. The second wife also died from eating poisoned mushrooms. The third wife died from a brain concussion from a hammer blow when she refused to eat the poisoned mushrooms. If a person is out to kill you, they'll find another way if the first way does not succeed. So you've got to accept the fact that sometimes what happens is that a person is out to destroy you because of their own problems or whatever it might be, and you've got to face it and accept it. Oh, I know there are some who are saying today, but Clyde, don't you understand? If the woman especially, and that's where a lot of the burden is placed, will just pray and believe, ultimately the marriage will be reconciled. And I say, I disagree with that for 2 reasons. Listen to me carefully. First, to say that if I pray and believe, ultimately the marriage has to be reconciled is to deny the freedom of choice. And any time the freedom of choice is denied, I take away all moral responsibility because then God becomes responsible for my decisions. Are you with me? In other words, we can actually go so far as to make God responsible and therefore produce irresponsibility. Secondly, I find that frequently when a person is saying, well, if you'll just pray and believe, what happens is they have a tendency to say all of the fault lies with the other person. And then they can become a little self-righteous and super spiritual, which pushes the person farther away. Because all they do is dump guilt on the other person. And love is not interested in dumping guilt. It's in redeeming and reconciling and restoring. And so we've got to come to the place that we accept the death of a marriage. We've got to face reality by stop living in the past. Oftentimes someone will say to me, Clyde, if I had only heard what you share in this seminar for singles 3 years ago, my marriage would still be alive. And I said, well, I've been saying it for over 12 years now. So it's not that. It's the fact that most of the time couples will not come to seminars. On one occasion, I was on staff at a church in Houston, Texas. We were doing Picking Up the Pieces for Singles on Tuesday nights. We were doing Growing Together, our couples seminar, on Thursday nights. We had 300 singles. We had 30 married people. Far more married people in the church, but it is more difficult to get them there because, well, if I go, I'm admitting I've got a problem. Let's face it. We could all look back and say, if I'd done this or this or this, everything would have been different, but we didn't. The only time I've ever heard of history being backed up was in Superman. If you recall in the movie Superman 1, the first movie of Superman, Superman did not like the fact that Lois Lane got killed, so he backed history up so he could rescue Lois Lane. But remember, that was in the movies. That's not in real life. You've got to come to the place that you stop living in the past. Then you've got to stop accepting responsibility for the former mate. Studies indicate that people who are married to alcoholics, if they go through an ended relationship, frequently marry another alcoholic. You ever wondered why? Very simple. They get their sense of worth out of being responsible for the irresponsible alcoholic. And if that marriage continued, And the alcoholic became sober, it would put a pressure on the marriage, because now then you've got two responsible people, and the one who's been totally responsible would no longer feel as worthy. No longer feel like they were better than the other person type thing. They're being overly responsible. I was doing a seminar in Lacey's Clyde. Am I being too responsible for my former husband? We've been divorced 3 years. He's living with another woman, but they're not married. But every week he brings his dirty clothes by, and I wash his clothes and iron his shirts. Do you wonder why there was a problem? He had a mother. Not a wife, a mother. And so you come to the place that you stop accepting responsibility for the former mate, and then you may have to cut some ties that would hold you to the past. For instance, sometimes it's the family members. Kathy and I were flying to Phoenix, Arizona to do a seminar, and I overheard two flight attendants. I did not hear the details, but I had the feeling that something was wrong. We laid a copy of the book on the seat. She began to comment about it, and we began to talk. She was in the process of going through a divorce, and she began to talk about what had happened, how that her mother had just called and come down on her very hard, because mother was saying, "I'm so embarrassed because you're getting the divorce that I do not feel free to go to church anymore. You know, what am I going to look like? I failed." Many of you have had a parent say something like this. "Well, we've never had a divorce in our family before. You've blackened our family name." Or, "What if you remarry? How will I introduce your new mate? This is Jane's second husband." And sometimes you will find yourself having to put some distance between you and your family in order that they can have time to grow up and let the wound heal. Or with children, especially in a death. I find that the children, older children especially, who have the most unresolved feelings towards the parent who has died, will frequently try to tie the surviving parent to the casket as a means of making amends for their feelings. We were in Norfolk, Virginia. A young man was sharing with me how that his father died a year earlier. But every time his mother talked about another man, or even thought about dating, he could just feel the anger boil within him. Well, as we talked, the problem was quite simple. He was angry with his father because his father had not shared with him as he was when he was alive. Here was a young boy that was growing up wanting his dad's attention, dad strokes, and dad was too busy doing something else. And because of the resentment that he had towards his father, who was now deceased, he was transferring that to his mother and tying her to the casket as a means of making amends to his father. Sometimes you have to put some distance between them and say, "Hey, I've got to go on with my life." And with your friends. It's very evident. In a death situation in the church, your friends come flocking to you for about 6 months. And then you'll notice they're not around as often. In a divorce, they go running away from you most of the time. You feel like that you ought to put a big A on your forehead and ring a bell and walk as the people with leprosy of years ago who would walk down the streets crying, "Unclean, unclean." But notice, ladies especially, you go to church. And as you go in, couples oriented, have you ever found yourself the center of attention? In other words, the other ladies have built a little fence around you to protect their mates from you because you see they're afraid their mate may think the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. And you find that your friends are no longer inviting you over when their husbands are around. When they're not, maybe, but not when he's around. And so you find yourself having to build some new friendships that you can have someone there when you need them in your life. Then, to make the most of this situation in which you find yourself, you've got to commit yourself to grow. It is a choice that you either make or reject. Now, when you and I come to the place that we choose to grow, we're going to face the fact that our situation will make us bitter or better. Clyde Lovett has a book entitled The Compassionate Side of Divorce. In the book, he says, divorce is acceptable when it is making one bitter rather than better. I understand what he's trying to say, and I understand the concept, but I disagree with the word choice because I believe that bitterness is a choice. A choice that we choose to accept or we reject it. Now then, if I am determined to grow through the situation in which I am experiencing, through which I'm going, I've got to first of all acknowledge that I'm not perfect, and that's the hardest part. See, if I can blame the other person totally, then I'm good. None of my faults, right? It was all his fault, wasn't it? Man, it was all her fault. You didn't have any blame in it, right? No. None of us are perfect, and we have got to come to the place that we recognize, since I'm not perfect, there is some room for growth in my life. And if I will grow, I will become a better person. I've got to accept the pain of growth. I was working out in a studio, a health club one day, and a man on the machine next to me turned and says, how many times does one have to work out before he stops sweating? I laughed, but I was trying to make sure I'd heard him, and I had. And I thought to myself, stop sweating. If you have a good workout, you're going to work up a sweat. More than that, you're going to have some pain. I walked in one day and told the director, hey, give me a high-intensity workout. I'd been working out for 6 months. I thought, man, I'm in shape now. I did five times as much as I normally did because he pushed me that hard. And for 6 days, I hurt. For two of them, I could hardly roll out of bed. That's how much I hurt. It's real. There's some pain. There'll be some pain as you work through picking up the pieces. As you begin to look at yourself, as you begin to look at some things out of your past and face them head on in order that you can become a healthy person. There is pain, but it's exciting because there's also healing. And so if you're going to make the most of this situation, you've got to commit yourself to grow. Then you've got to get in touch with where you are right now. Sometimes I'll have a person call and says, Klein, how do I get to your office? I say, well, where are you? I have an office on the north side of Houston. I say, if you're up in Conroe, I'll tell you to come south. If you're down in Galveston, I'll tell you to come north. Frequently, people want to get somewhere, but they don't know where they are first, and therefore, it's hard to get there. And so I say, let's get in touch with the feelings that you have. I'm going to share with you some feelings that I think everyone goes through any time a relationship is ended. Whether it is by death, divorce, or just the breakup of a close courtship. First, confusion. What happened? Nurses will tell you frequently in the hospital when a person is critically ill, terminally ill, they know that that person is at the point of death, but let that person die and there's a confusion. And sometimes the nurses will have to get the family members out so they can deal with the situation. In a divorce, I didn't know anything was wrong. Oh, we didn't have a perfect marriage, but I thought it was a good marriage. It was better than the marriage next door. A lady shared how on Thursday evening, she and her husband went out to celebrate their 17th wedding anniversary. He took her to a fancy restaurant, gave her a beautiful anniversary gift. The next morning, as they both prepared to leave for work, he turned to her and said, now listen, when you come home from work, do not be surprised that all my things are gone. We've not been hit by a thief. I have rented an apartment. I'm in love with another woman. Adios, sayonara, goodbye. What happened? Confusion. As that confusion hits, God in His love for us sends a case of shock, His tranquilizer. Have you ever seen some people at the time of death, they're kind of giddy-like? Or maybe if they're not giddy, they're just kind of smiling and it seems like nothing has hit them. That's shock. That happens sometimes in a divorce situation. There is that shock syndrome, that way of kind of dealing with it a little bit at a time. And then as the shock begins to wear off, we begin to face fear. How am I going to make it by myself? Clyde, how am I going to make it financially? He died and did not leave enough insurance money. How am I going to make it financially? We cannot even support one home, much less two family units. How am I going to make it emotionally? I know that he came home and stuck his nose in a newspaper as he watched the television simultaneously. But how am I going to talk to that knot on the log that's not there. At least there was a body in there to talk to, even though he never responded. How am I going to make it physically? None of you ladies, when you left tonight, turned on a light in your apartment or home so that you would not have to go back to a dark house, did you? None of you have ever stated to a friend, I would love to go see that particular movie, or I'd love to go to that event, but I am afraid to walk out into the parking lot and get in my car after dark alone. And so you began to face that feeling of fear. How am I going to make it? And as that begins to surface, you began to remember all the hurts, all the things that happened. In a death, you remember them, but you have a tendency to deify the deceased, so you push them aside. But they're still there. And the tragedy is that you're never able to feel free to talk about them. Then as you began to get in touch with those hurts, you zero in on the area of rejection. Wait a minute, Clyde. My mate died. What did you mean, rejection? One lady put it so well. She said, my plans were that my husband and I would live together happily married until I became 80, 85, and when I became a little feeble, I would die, and he'd give me a good funeral, and 2 weeks later, before he could get involved with anyone else, he would die. And that sorry sorry last, he walked out on me. He left me right here. Rejection. Of course, no one ever feels rejection in divorce. Listen to me, though. Not only does the person who was left feel rejected, but the person who did the walking felt rejected. Not at the time of walking, but 2 or 3 years earlier when they had cried out to that person, hey, will you hear me? Will you relate to me? The tragedy of marriage counseling so often is repeated in these words. A couple comes in. They've got problems. There's a third person involved. But as I began to listen, I find that the person who is now involved with the third person had tried to get the other mate to come with him for counseling 2 or 3 years earlier. And the second one refused. And after they refused and refused, finally they kind of gave up, got involved with someone else, and now then you've got all these complicated feelings. Rejection. Rejection in the breakup of courtship. They can say what they want to about, well, teenagers break up and it's just puppy love. But listen, friends, a hurt to a puppy is just as real as a hurt to an adult. Whether it be a marriage, whether it be a courtship, whenever there is that breakup, there is that pain and that feeling of rejection. Rejection is followed by anger. Anger, first of all, at yourself. Why didn't I make him go to the doctor and get a good thorough physical? Why didn't I make him stop using so much stuff? Why didn't I make us go for counseling? Why didn't I talk him into going for counseling? Why? Anger towards yourself because of what you didn't do, and then anger towards the former mate, the former boyfriend, girlfriend. I'm sorry, so-and-so. He wouldn't take care of himself. I told him he was too fat. I told him he was eating too much salt. I'll never forget one lady who expressed this anger towards her deceased husband. She said he was a master plumber. 1 week to the day after his death, all the plumbing in the house went kaput. She said, I wanted to dig him up out of the grave and slap his face and say, why? Now, that anger was very, very, very real. Anger in a divorce situation. Somebody walks in just about the time you're talking about how that sorry so-and-so. Yeah, he was. Oh, no, he was a good guy. And they look at you puzzled like, what's going on? But there's that seesaw that I find so often in breakups like that. And then anger towards the world in general and God in particular. In a death, God, I read in the Bible that if I would pray and believe, you'd hear my prayer and you'd answer my prayer. And I believed that, God, I told all my friends you were going to heal my loved one who was dying of cancer. And they died. God, you lied to me. I believe the reason some people have trouble going back to church after a funeral is because they're still angry at God. In a divorce, God, I did everything I could. I became such a submissive wife, God, that I laid out in the door and let him walk up my back with his golf shoes on as he walked out the door. And he still walked out. A friend of mine taught a course in Phoenix, Arizona on how to be the perfect wife. and said, if you'll just do what I'm teaching you, your husband will be the happiest man in the world. Came home one day to find a note from her husband. I'm leaving you for the lady across the street whom I see more than I see you. That anger towards God, though, sometimes takes the form of being an anger towards the church. One of the first people I met when I got involved in singles work was a lady at one time had been a departmental pianist and Sunday school teacher in a Baptist church in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. When her pastor found out that she was going through a divorce, he came by and voluntarily resigned her of all of her teaching positions. When I met her and tried to invite her to come to our church, she said, And the only way we ever got her to come was when our organist, who was going through a divorce, went and invited her. Then she believed that somebody could care and accept her in a situation like that. Tremendous anger towards God. It took us over 6 months because she did not believe that anybody could possibly care, especially not the church. An anger towards the world in general, but especially towards God. Anger is valid. The Bible says in Ephesians 4:26, be angry and sin not. But it hastens to make another statement. It says, let not the sun go down on your wrath and thus give a foothold to the devil. I believe that any anger that is not resolved in 24 hours becomes infected anger, and that's bitterness. If I get a splinter in my finger, I take it out, it hurts. But if I leave it there, it festers. The Bible is so acutely aware of the destructiveness of bitterness that it says, beware lest there exist a root of bitterness among you by which many are defiled. Bitterness does not destroy the person you resent. It destroys you. It literally eats you alive because you're so consumed with that anger, that hostility, that resentment, that you don't know what to do. Give you a test. Right now, think about the person you resent most. Even if it's Khomeini or whomever you have to think of, and think of all the things you'd like to do to that person. Now, if you were to do that, and I stopped you after a minute, I would ask you, what effect did it have on the person you resented? None. What effect did it have on you? You will find that your muscles became tense. Some of the acids in your body began to churn, and it was destroying you, not the person you resent. Let me just give you a couple of tests to find if you have any resentment. Any of you who have lost a mate by death, this is the way I let you test it for yourself. Putting it in the situation of a lady who's lost a mate by death, you can know that all of your bitterness is gone when you can have all the bill collectors hounding you because he died and did not leave enough insurance money. Your electricity is about to be turned off. You've been tossed back among the male sharks in the dating game. And you're happy for him in that he is in heaven with God with no problems, no fears, no concerns. For one of you who has lost a mate through divorce, I'll give you this illustration. A woman whose husband left her can know that all of her bitterness is gone when she can go to the wedding of her former husband and be happy for him as he leaves the church, having just married the most beautiful young lady in the community, and wish him well as he prepares to go on his honeymoon to Acapulco, where you've always wanted to go and never got to go, using the money he got from the oil well that was struck on the property he got in the divorce settlement. You're not there? You mean you cannot be happy for him and go up and just hug you next time, I'm happy for you? Well, in the unit on how to trust after being burned, I will tell you how to get there. I will give you a prescription that I promise you, if you work it, will bring you to the place that you could actually do that. I was doing a seminar on one occasion. I gave that illustration, and a lady says, Clyde, can I put a bomb in the car? I said, no bombs, please. The exercise involves a written exercise. She went home and wrote out 27 pages on her former husband. 10 weeks later, she went to his wedding, took their two small children so that the children could be there with Daddy, be happy for Daddy, and have permission from her to love Daddy and love Daddy's new wife. who became healthy. She and the children. Bitterness. But it's something we all go through. I believe it is almost impossible to go through a divorce situation without some bitterness. And then there's a feeling of guilt. Guilt and death, yes. I did not understand why. I kept hearing people say, if only. And every time I heard it, it sounded like they were on a guilt trip. And I kept wondering, why? What's the reason for a feeling of guilt in a death? One day I heard a preacher jokingly say, my wife and I would never consider divorce. As a matter of fact, the word is not even in our vocabulary. Murder? 1,000 times. Listen to me carefully. It is very hard for a person to be married to another person 10, 15, 20 years and not at least once become so angry momentarily that you just thought, boy, if they would die, I would be out of this zoo and have a chance at a good relationship. I find this is frequently true with ladies who are married to alcoholics. Now, I never divorced him, but God, if he got killed in a car wreck, then I'd be free and I could go on and find someone decent. You let that person die, and the devil will put you on a major guilt trip immediately. I mean, you can feel it beginning to boil within you instantaneously. What about divorce? I believe that the first part of the guilt in a divorce situation is that by the time the divorce is final, you've probably wished them dead at least 5 times. You know, God, if they'd just go ahead and die, we wouldn't have all this problem with the property settlement. The kids in custody, I wouldn't have to worry about visitation. And God, I wouldn't be branded so. You know, there's more dignity in the sense of being a widower than being a divorcee. You know, God, can you just help me out a little bit? You know, God, I'm your loyal servant, God. You know, you're for the good people, aren't you, God? You know, that type of thing. And let them... But there's a second part of it, and that is for the 1,001 little things that one did that helped kill the marriage. You see, I do not believe marriages are killed by one big event. Even a third person. It's not the one big event. It's the multiplicity of little things that slowly poisons it. In our book for couples, we're commenting on the fact that the secret of keeping the romance in the relationship is to take out the garbage data. That is, deal with the little things. Because if you'll deal with those little things, you'll find that you'll not allow them to become big things, to become infected, and thus bring it to the point of destruction. Then there's that feeling of failure. This is especially true for women because they have been led to believe that their most important task was to be a good wife. And here I failed at that important task of being a good wife, and I failed. Many people do not experience the same thing. They say, oh, men say, I've still got my job. But some of them will feel like they've really failed. I'll never forget a friend of mine who turned to me one day and says, Clyde, when my marriage fell apart, it was not just my marriage. It was my whole life that was shattered. That feeling of failure. And then loneliness. The number one problem among single adults is loneliness. Part of the reason it is such a real problem is that I do not believe most of us understand the difference between loneliness and aloneness. Many times I'll hear people say, well, the answer to loneliness is get busy. I've never seen more exhausted, lonely people than single adults. Man, they'll go till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Then they'll fall in the bed, exhausted, but lonely. But on the other hand, it's not aloneness either. Because some of the loneliest people in Oklahoma City, or wherever you are, will not be singles at a singles bar or a single seminar, but some of the loneliest people in this town will be lying 18 inches or less away from the one they call mate, whom they've not touched emotionally in years. Loneliness is not having anyone with whom you have that sense of relationship, that closeness, that gives you the freedom to share who you are and where you are at a given moment. That's loneliness. We'll talk about how to overcome loneliness, but we're going to deal with loneliness, not aloneness, because I believe we all need some aloneness, but not loneliness. But I hasten to say, if you and I are going to make the most of our situation, we're going to have to get off a pity pot. Many of the singles that I meet, I feel they ought to have as their national anthem Jerry Reed's song, "She Got the Gold Mine and I Got the Shaft." I walk in and I hear them talking about how badly they got shafted. I hear widowers talking about how bad things are for them. I was speaking at a meeting recently. They were talking about how it was harder on them. They were the ones that really had it bad. I mean, because they couldn't help it. In other words, I got treated worse than other people did. And then I'll go in and I'll hear a bunch of divorcees in there talking about, man, how bad they got shafted. He got all the money, or she took me for everything I had. Or I lost the house and I lost this. They go on ad infinitum about all the bad things that happened to them and wonder why nobody wants to be around them. Every time I'm around them, I think of the man who is eating Limburger cheese and got some caught in his beard and said, "The whole world stinks." I'm around these singles and they're talking about how bad things are, and I began to find myself thinking, hey, if that's true, notice whom you are having as friends, other stinkers. Why? Because only stinkers want to be around stinkers. And so if you're attracting a bunch of stinkers, realize you're sitting on pity pot. In my counseling ministry, I will allow people 3 visits on pity pot. Then I use the cowboy boots that I always wear, applied at the appropriate part of their anatomy to get them off. I have just a short time with you. And so I'm going to simply tell you that if you start dwelling on pity pot, I'm going to apply the cowboy boots, verbally or otherwise, to get you off. Because I believe the best days of our life are not behind us, but in front of us. It depends upon how you look at it. You see, a problem is an opportunity to grow. Every time a tragedy happens, it is an opportunity for me to face myself and say, what are my needs? How can I grow? Because if I grow, I become a better person. Therefore, better people will want to be around me, and better things will happen. In making the most, it's our choice.
A person is not capable of loving another more than they love themselves. This statement expresses the need addressed in the second session of the Picking Up the Pieces seminar led by Clyde Besson. In this particular unit, Clyde will share spiritual truths for developing a healthy self-love. Let me challenge you to listen attentively as we join Clyde Besson for the second of 10 sessions of this successful single living seminar.
As Mike has said, no one can love another person more than they love themselves. Studies have indicated that one's academic achievement, job satisfaction, and relational happiness primarily deals with their self-esteem or self-love. If this is true, why is it that so many of us have such a problem loving ourselves? Thomas Harris, in his book, I'm Okay, says it's because here's Dad 6 feet tall, the child is 2 feet tall. Dad always seems to do what is right. The child never seems to do what is right. And I says, I hear you. I understand what you're saying, but why? Why is it that we still have that problem? And as I was thinking about that one day, my mind was directed back to the book of Exodus, where it talks about how God visits the iniquity of the parents to the third and fourth generations. That had always troubled me because I could not understand how a just God could hold a child responsible for that which the child did not do. But then I noticed something. It does not say that God is holding us responsible. It is saying simply that we are influenced or affected by what is happening to us. In other words, if a parent has a low self-esteem, it is impossible for them to give that self-esteem to a child. For instance, I have found among alcoholics three basic problems. One, low self-esteem. Two, high bitterness. Three, high guilt level. Therefore, it is almost impossible for an alcoholic parent to give true approval to a child. And that child will grow up being influenced by that and will develop what I call an approval deficiency. And so as I came to realize that what we were talking about was the curse of original sin, I came to see how that curse has influenced our lives. First of all, society is influenced by that curse. Now keep in mind, your mind, my mind, is a computer. What it does is it stores everything that ever happens to us. Every time I make a decision, it runs through my computer, it computes everything that is there, and then it makes a decision. All right, I'm influenced by such things as being born on the wrong side of the tracks. I was reared in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Baton Rouge is the capital city. It is also an industrial city. It just so happened, it seemed, that the people whose parents were professionals, doctors, lawyers, and so forth, lived on the south side of town and went to Baton Rouge High. Those whose parents worked in the refineries lived on the north side of the town, the Estruma part, and went to Estruma High School. On Tuesday before Baton Rouge High and Estruma played one year, there were two students from Baton Rouge High who were on a local DJ's program. During the program, he asked, "By the way, whom is Baton Rouge High playing this week?" And they stuttered and stammered as if they could not remember. And finally said, "Oh, you know, that school across the tracks." The Baton Rouge High football team wishes it had never been said because it became the rally cry for Estruma, and they literally mopped up on Baton Rouge High that week. As a matter of fact, I think they put two Baton Rouge High football players in the hospital. They were hitting so hard. But being born on the wrong side of the tracks. One time I was pastoring a church in Pasadena, Texas. Pasadena is to Houston what Estruma was to Baton Rouge. It is the refinery part of the Houston area. There was a lady, a single school teacher who was a member of our church. One day she came and says, "Clyde, I'm going to move over to the southwest side of Houston, even though it'll mean a 30-mile drive each way back and forth to work. The reason is, all I can find over here in Pasadena is a bunch of blue-collar kickers." Well, she moved, and 2 weeks after she moved, she met a man whom she subsequently married, who lived two blocks from where she had previously lived. But that idea of being born on the wrong side of the tracks, are we can be handicapped. Some handicaps are very obvious. Others are not. I acknowledge that I have a slight handicap in that certain sounds are hard for me to pronounce, especially TH sounds. And I'm glad there are translations sometimes of the Bible that don't always have to have that TH, like beareth all things, endureth all things, believeth all things, because I acknowledge that that's a problem I have. I've learned to use other words than some big words that just cause me all kinds of trouble. I recognize that and acknowledge it. That is, society has been influenced by this curse. The church has also been influenced by this curse. Now, to understand this, you've got to understand what I call the dynamic tension. For every good thing God made, the devil created two perversions, believing I'd find one, and in my horror of it, backed myself into the opposite ditch, all the way across to the opposite side. Peter Lord comes up with the same concept by saying that we are dealing with the highway and ditches. The highway to happiness is not way off in the mountains somewhere. It's right down the middle of the broad road going in the opposite direction. But have you ever noticed what is on either side of a highway? A ditch. And it matters not which ditch you get into. If you're in a ditch, you're in a ditch. The church, through the years, has had trouble staying out of the ditches. God intended for us to be in tension, drawing us towards the middle of the road, and we're bouncing out of ditches. For instance, the very idea of self-love confuses a lot of people, because a lot of people equate self-love with selfishness, but they're not the same. I was doing a seminar in Phoenix, Arizona. A man called the pastor and said, "Don't you see what he's going to be talking about? Self-love. That's sin." He said, "No, it's not. Because the Bible commands us to love one another as we love ourselves." You see, selfishness is actually a form of self-hate. The selfish person basically says, "I do not like myself, therefore I do not believe you could like me. If you do not like me, you would never give me anything, so if I'm ever going to have anything, I've got to take it." A person with a truly healthy self-love can believe others could love them even as they love others, enough to give people an opportunity to give them something. That is self-love, or the old nature. I know the Bible says, "In man dwelleth nothing good," but I think we get into a ditch when we make a statement like one preacher who said, "Why is it so hard to give your life to Jesus? Don't you know that you're nothing but garbage?" I don't like that statement, because I like Ethel Waters' way of putting it better. God don't make no junk. And the Bible says that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. We're made in the image of God, little less than God, because Psalm 8 literally translates in the Hebrew, "less than God," not than the angels. The angels are God's servants to take care of His children. We are His children. We are above the angels. We're little less than God Himself. Or the idea of take up your cross, or self-denial. And I think many of us are confused by that, like I was for a while. I thought to think, well, if I really deny myself, I'm always putting myself down. Like the woman who stands to sing a solo on Sunday morning and begins by, "You know I don't have a good voice and cannot sing well, but the words of this song are so beautiful. Will you please give a listen? And I want to cry out, ma'am, if you cannot sing, why torture yourself and others too? You know, do that which you can do it." You know, it's that hook. "Mama, she can't sing, but she sure is on ball." Hey, listen to me. God never intended for Christians to put themselves down, because every Christian is dynamic. We're filled with a dynamo, the power of God Himself. What it means is not to deny in the sense that I have no talents. It is to acknowledge who is Lord. When Jesus Christ was crucified, He said, "Father, into Thy hands I commend my spirit." And at that point, He yielded control of His life, as He'd always done. And I believe that what we're dealing with in self-denial or take up your cross is the Lordship of Christ. We acknowledge that He is Lord of our lives. However, the area in which we are most influenced is not society or the church. It's the home. God's first source of spiritual and psychological values. For a child to develop a healthy self-esteem or self-love, they need approval and acceptance. However, frequently a child grows up without approval. They find themselves constantly facing non-approval. Non-approval, first of all, in constant criticism. No matter what they do, it's always wrong. Like the little girl who loved her mother, saw the rose in the garden, went out, cut it, took it in, and says, "Mom,